Maybe I'll just talk about it when we record. Yep.
Go ahead and start.
Okay, so I watched her last three videos. I was really interested in the Paul Rossi one, but I was also interested in the one where you mentioned me, which was the Carl Jung one, and then the psychedelics one as well, and the last one you did with where you were talking about Jonathan Pageau was in there, and a little bit more of Peterson. So there's a lot of stuff going on that's really interesting.
It's a lot of stuff going on right now.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts? Because I often, so those maybe should do a little bit of introduction. Yeah. Sevilla has a channel. I always want to say it's a quality experience, but it's a quality existence.
Quality existence, yeah.
I don't know why experience always comes to mind, but Sevilla has a channel, Existence, where you've been doing this for just about as long as I've been doing mine, about 3 years.
Right. Yeah, about 3 years. I'm a lot less diligent than you. I really admire, you know, how much stuff you put out there.
I'm not sure it's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing.
But you, I mean, you, Persig's work, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and then his follow-up novel, deeply impacted you.
Yeah, they did.
And, you know, I had zero experience with any mm-hmm. of this, and you know, pretty quickly, I had a conversation with you a couple years ago now.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years now, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And well, would you, just for those who, and I'll put a link to our previous conversation so they can kind of get up to speed and we've talked about then, but would you just kind of give a little tidbit about what Persig and is about and what he's doing in these two books that you spent a lot of time working through?
Okay, so let me talk a little bit about Peterson, which is our common link.
Yeah.
So Peterson had a video called What Matters? And that's like 10 years ago. And in that he says something like, it's not matter, it's meaning that creates reality. That's basically Persig's premise. I mean, it was just such a mind-blowing thing to say. And it's the thing that got me interested in Peterson to begin with, because it just made so much sense, because, you know, the subject object world, here we are, there's the stuff, and that's all there is to it. It doesn't make sense to me. It just didn't resonate. And when he said that, and then I was involved in you know, reading a lot of stuff at that time, and very influenced by Peterson, probably in a large part because of that, but some other stuff that I was doing in social work and studying therapy. So Persig says that it is quality, it is value that creates reality. It's value itself. It's the relationship between the subject and the object. And that relationship is what drives reality forward and creates, you know, and a pattern will result of that. And a pattern can be anything from the inorganic to the idea to the intellectual. And all these things are equally real. And sometimes they are more enduring and sometimes they're less enduring. So my channel is just trying to figure it out. And a lot of the channel has been kind of awkward because I've been going from step one and documenting it. So I'm no expert on Persig by any stretch of the imagination. I'm certainly in much better verse than I was 2 years ago when I talked to you. Because now I'm picking through Lila and putting it and putting up those episodes and commentary and everything. So that's what I'm doing through a Persigian lens, but with a lot of other influence as well, including heavily influenced by Peterson still and extraneous stuff around that. And Pageau's are totally influential, Vervaeke, you know, the whole corner of our internet.
Yeah.
Which is developed in light of this. So that's where I am. I just keep going. I should do more, and I would like to do more.
I'm not sure quantity, in my case, I'm not sure quantity is always a friend of quality. But you know what, part of the reason that your work continues to come up in my mind when, as I'm watching Peterson and Pageau quite a bit lately, because of course Peterson's been mm-hmm. back on the scene.
Yeah.
Is that this aspect, you know, I think there's something deeply right about what you just laid out is deeply correct. And Persig, of course, popularized that. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance mm-hmm. was a very popular book.
Very popular.
And it also strikes me that in a lot of ways, you're sort of doing with YouTube what I am, which is, I mean, I basically have been using YouTube to think out loud mm-hmm. through, you know, Peterson, Peugeot, pretty much, you know, Tom Holland. I mean, all this stuff mm-hmm. that I've been sort of ruminating on, and YouTube, you can do a lot of things with it. You can show cats, you can show mm-hmm. lectures, you can also think out loud and have mm-hmm. a distributed conversation with mm-hmm. A lot of people, which has proven really helpful. And mm-hmm. For those who are mostly familiar with Peterson, his conversations with Sam Harris, for example, really centered around this aspect yes. that you've been hitting on.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's why those conversations were so important and so iconic in the whole, you know, in the whole trajectory of what Peterson did and how he affects us.
Yeah. And when you'd see, I mean, this materialist, the world of objects, you know, mm-hmm. Peterson begins Maps of Meaning, world of objects, you know, form for action. The world of objects just doesn't take value into consideration. Mm-hmm. And it's therefore not a world that any human being can ever live in.
No. And we're seeing so much problem from that now, because what we're doing is we've got these ideas, you know, these concepts, and we're acting as if these concepts are reality, and they're not. They don't have that basis in reality. And what you said in your last video that really makes sense is it's a fraction. It's cutting heaven away from earth. You know, heaven is that intellectual realm. Earth is the grounded reality. And it's this modernity, I think, has separated these two. And this is the problem we're seeing.
And I, you know, I'm gonna fuss a little bit here, because when we use this word reality, I mean, this just reveals our, you know, our bias, because when we use, I listen very carefully when people say real or reality, mm-hmm. and they almost always mean physical, mm-hmm. but yet as your work points out, if that reality much more deeply means basically that which governs, that which mm-hmm. that which shapes, that which colonizes, that which finally endures and has its way, mm-hmm. and the physical world is the expression of the other tricky word for us, of course, is spiritual, mm-hmm. but that's traditionally the belief that the spiritual world moves the physical world, and even mm-hmm. hardcore materialists can't you know, correct their language, because they keep having to use this word spirit or spiritual, mm-hmm. and in its deepest ancient sense of that which, you know, for example, Jesus' use of wind and spirit, you know, the wind moves the trees. the movement of the trees is dependent upon the wind mm-hmm. for its locomotion. So So, you know, a lot of, you know, often when I'm working through this stuff, you know, I think you've in some points, you know, I haven't by any means listened to everything that you've put out, but I found you to have a real capacity to language this in a pretty compelling way. Your commentary on it was Peugeot's conversation with Rationality Rules.
Oh no, it was Adam Friended.
Oh, it was Adam Friended. That's right. Yes. You know, you should, Adam should probably have you on his channel, because I thought this new atheism for many people created an enormous blind spot that they can't comprehend. And in many ways, from my corner with Christian ministers, what we wound up with are sort of two disconnected worlds. And mm-hmm. I think the inability of many churches to effectively engage variety of aspects about this world is because of that split.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think a lot of your work is very helpful in pointing out, and others obviously have done this, the fact value distinction. C.S. Lewis goes over this repeatedly, but I think a lot of the ways that you've learned from Persig to talk about this have been really helpful in saying, oh, there's this huge blind spot mm-hmm. that we're just sort of avoiding.
Yeah, can I read you something, because I've got some insight into that blind spot through the Persig lens. And one thing about all these things is, if they're making very good observations of our experience, then they're going to line up in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
you know, if there's a metaphysical structure to this stuff, which I think is the key point, then the metaphysics are going to line up, even though they're expressed differently. So here's something that I want to bring up. Okay, so this is in chapter 2 of Lila, and it's the first paragraph. He says, where the physical climate changes suddenly from high temperature to low temperature, and from high atmospheric pressure to low atmospheric pressure, the result is usually a storm. When the social climate changes from preposterous social restraint of all intellect to a relative abandonment of all social patterns, the result is a hurricane of social forces. That hurricane is the history of the 20th century. And so the reason I want to bring that up is because one problem we have is we dismiss the social level as unreal, the social patterns, these ephemeral, these things, and we're always trying to explain them away with evolution or dismiss them altogether. And in this model of reality, the social patterns, all of them are equally real as anything on any other level, as any material reality, as any great idea. And a lot of the problems that we're having, I think, is living in this intellectual realm and dismissing the social patterns altogether. And these patterns are not biology acted out in society. They are their own thing. You know, they have biological support. They have a biological substrate. They're populated with biology itself, but the patterns are emergent. It's strong. It's, I guess, the best way to put it. I don't fully understand this concept, so I'm on tricky ground here, but it's something like strong emergence. So these patterns, even though they have vestiges, even they have support from biology, they cannot be explained with this, all these evolutionary sciences. And it's not until we can reunite with the reality of the social level that we can get this back. And I think, another further way to parallel this, or what another further way to illustrate it, is something you brought up in your in the last video, or the one before, which is a medieval, and Peugeot says this all the time, a medieval consciousness, a medieval stance, a two-eyed stance that we have to reintegrate, because modernity and rationality and the Enlightenment has severed this.
I think that's right. And the videos that I've put out this week have mostly been focusing on Peugeot, mm-hmm. and how I've, when I first talked to Bernd Power and he said, this is my favorite Lewis book. And I thought, this is one of the few Lewis books I've never read. And then when I read it, The Discarded Image, An Introduction to Medieval and Renaissance Literature. That doesn't sound like anything a Christian Mm-mm. minister should, Mm-mm. Be interested in. I didn't really understand Lewis's project. As you walk through this, what you just did over the last few minutes, what occurs mm-hmm. to me though is the complete scramble of our present situation, because right now culturally we sort of have this battle mm-hmm. between the woke and the conservatives.
Yes.
And wokeism on one hand wants to say, social reality is very real and biological reality is inaccessible to us. And of course, the intellectual dark web pushback was, whoa, wait a minute. You can't just dismiss biological reality. Biological reality, in a sense, creates social reality. And both are, in that sense, as I do with the Wilfred Sellers stuff. I mean, it's either covering up one eye or the other, and they're sort of doing this. Mm-hmm. But I think Persig notes that no, social reality is real, Mm-hmm. Biological reality is real. Mm-hmm. And the thing we have to figure out is how, in fact, they relate, because they are deeply intertwined. And, you know, both, you know, one of the things that I think it's taken me, you know, I've listened to Peterson now quite a bit for 3 years. Sure. And often it feels like I'm still just a beginner in terms of understanding what is happening with this stuff. But part of why Peterson got my attention is because he, more than many, really began to get into this question of the emergence that happens from the back and forth of, and there's a lot of ways to map this, heaven and earth, spirit mm-hmm. and nature, social and biological, that these two things just keep working together. Brett Weinstein, for example, you know, I think to his credit, recognized that human beings are a combination of the genetic and the cultural track. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, he doesn't get the balance right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Peterson basically says the biological track has been deeply colonized by the social and cultural for a very long time. And so if you're sort of dismissive of either, mm-hmm. your picture will fail.
I think that's true. And I think an important point to make is that wokeness, even though they seem to be recognizing the social level, are actually doing it in the intellectual realm.
Yes.
These are conceptual recognition. This isn't actually getting down on the ground and observing, you know, the social level. If they were doing that, then some of these theories would actually be implementable without force, let's just say.
Right. And practical. I mean, I've lived my whole life in doing this kind of work amongst African Americans, mm-hmm. Haitians, Dominicans, and I see all the woke stuff and I say, yeah, you know, a lot of the social narratives have, you know, I don't really have a lot of problem with them noticing all kinds of inequities and difficulties. Mm-hmm. All of that I've certainly seen my whole life. What I don't see them bringing to the table is much of anything deeply helpful.
Yeah,
for
that's right.
For real people that I've always known and lived with. And, mm-hmm. you know, many others have, you know, it was really telling when John McWhorter, who obviously has dismissive take mm-hmm. on religion, sort of, you know, dismisses all of this as religion. I thought, yeah, that's right. It's kind of a cheap religion that religious people have been using too. So I think he really got that right.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, because the faithfulness of the woke to this religion, you know, you can't get in there. I mean, they have the purchase on the definition of racism, and it's you know, it's so deeply set that if you stray outside of that, and it's very effective. It's like blackmail, really.
It's status, you know, blackmail.
Yeah. And so that makes it a very difficult thing to counter. I'm glad to see some things happening. I'm glad to see McWhorter getting involved with this FAIR heterodox approach to anti-racism, which, you know, it is an important thing. I mean, the fact that this is coming up means that it probably should, means that we haven't dealt with it effectively. You know, there's been great, obviously everyone knows, we've already talked about this, there's been great strides, civil rights and all that, but there's still residual stuff going on that we really don't quite understand and that needs to be addressed. It's just that this critical race theory is so, first of all, it's only in the intellectual realm. It's only theoretical. It's de-resourcing instead of resourcing. You know, it's like embrace your victimhood rather than how are we gonna really work to make things better in a practical way and in a true way. And it's also so reductionist, you know, it's so simplified and it's so awkward, you know, that's when, you know, it's not cohesive, because it's perplexing and you don't even really know what to do. you know, in yeah. this modality. So everyone just kind of goes, okay, I'll just do what you tell me.
Yep. It actually reduces the agency of all parties. Mm-hmm. And again, yeah. I think, you know, for me, part of how Vervaeke's been helpful is, you know, and talked about this quite a bit, a big contribution of his work is giving us new language to talk about some of these contexts in a sharper, more accurate, better mm-hmm. way. Yeah. And the irony, the takeaway of a lot of this critical theory is that it actually reduces the agency of both Black people and white people, because they're both sort of slaves. The Black people are slaves to whiteness or white mm-hmm. supremacy, mm-hmm. and the white people are slaves to the whiteness and white supremacy that's inside of them. And so actually everybody loses agency, and the only people who seem to gain agency are those who are touting this theory. And right. in that way, it has many of the negative qualities of what religion has become in the secular frame, mm-hmm. and very few of the positive qualities. And that's right. So it's a real problem. But
yeah,
you know, that's, you know, with, you know, it's hard, you know, I try to make sure that my channel doesn't get too far down the whole anti-wokeism thing, because mm-hmm. there are traps in there too.
That's,
you know,
sure.
suddenly you're simply mm-hmm. reactive. You're parasitic. Wokeism is parasitic on deeper structures that Peugeot tries to point out, which he points out, I think, beautifully in his parasitic storytelling video. But then anti-wokeism can become parasitic off of wokeism. And it's like, no, you're not going to help yourself. You know, you're not going to help the story just becoming a second level parasite. Because
right.
the point of all of this is to get a better handle on reality. And I don't mean physicality, on the way the world really works. And again, I, you know, part of why I'm starting to dub Peugeot the apostle of purpose is because he continues to go back and say, all of these things are not arbitrary. And of course, right. when you use that word arbitrary, you are addressing the founding creation myth of that is developed in modernity that says there is no such thing as purpose. Value is simply derivative from material emergence. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's arbitrary. But, and again, this is where I keep coming back to your work, because in an interesting way, Persig has to say, all of this value can't be arbitrary. There is something behind the world that is better expressed in value than physicality. Mm-hmm. Physicality serves value. And that, you know, anybody who recognizes that deep point right away sees that, well, now the new atheists are really back on their heels, because it exposes a lot of the issues. And again, Peterson went after Sam Harris pretty hard when he would say things like, you know, where is the value in Elvis's guitar? Because a guitar that was owned by Elvis Presley has value, which that we express and recognize, that you're not simply going to dismiss, but you can take apart that guitar and never find that value. It isn't in the physical realm. Where mm-hmm. is the value in Elton John's glass? And they use that example in the conversation. A glass that Elton John used in a movie or on a set or something like that has a value that is not carried in the physical thing. Now, Sam mm-hmm. Harris could come back and basically say, well, that's in the intersubjective. But Persig, and I think your work, continues to come back and say, that's not deep enough, that mm-hmm. you're not really getting at this problem of value. And just simply trying to locate it in the intersubjective eventually will place you on a footing that no human being can actually thrive on. And I think that is in many ways the heart, you know, one of the ways into seeing the problem of the meaning crisis.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Because these things that we see are the after effect of value. You know, they are quality patterns, but they're only half the story. You have this dynamic value that creates, that makes the where the relationship can be found. And then you have the after effect, which are these patterns, which of course can be physical all the way up to, you know, they're all the way down to inorganic, all the way up to intellectual. So the value itself obviously can never be measured. And that's not the point. The point is we know, you know, there is no doubt as to that value. For example, Elvis's guitar, maybe the guitar itself would be, you know, a $50 thing, but at Sotheby's, it's a $50,000 thing.
Right. Right. So now I wanted to get some of this out there because, I mean, even when it's really, when you say quality, mm-hmm. people hear that merely as a status variant, but that's mm-hmm. not how you're using that word. Mm-mm. What do you mean by the word quality?
Quality means, I would say one definition would be it's what comes out, what strikes you, what is the relevance realization of the best in that moment, in that context, in that relationship. It's that relationship of this is what stands out. And it can be low quality too. I mean, there's an analogy that he uses that the quality of sitting on a hot stove, you know, at that moment of relationship with the hot stove, that is definitely low quality. And, you know, Peterson says, I mean, that the one thing that human beings can agree on is pain. You know, so low quality is definitely a factor. So what is it that differentiates your perception of something from the miasma of nothing or the void or the miasma of just every possibility? And I'd say that's one of the better ways to explain it.
And so a quality existence, how does existence then function? I mean, you've chosen that mm-hmm. as the title of your channel. You forefront it quite a bit. You know, what does that title really mean?
Well, I'm hoping it means, and again, this is a work in progress, you know, it's just me trying to figure it out in front of everyone, which is, I don't know, maybe I should have integrated all this material, then gotten out there, but I didn't. So it's trying to figure out how to actually function with this as a metaphysical principle, as this being the bottom of understanding. And Persick has a lot of different ways, you know, to do it. And so do other people. I mean, there's other people who, again, follow something very similar. Persick is someone who has found a pattern, you know, that seems to be eternal, that seems to be, that takes a bigger bite out of reality than other patterns. And those are the best patterns. That's what, you know, Poincaré would say, the best patterns are the ones in Zenyar of Motorcycle Maintenance. One of his moments of realization is this mathematician Poincaré who says, what is the pattern that can be used the most and is the simplest? You know, which sort of goes together because it has to be simple and scaling. And, you know, what scales best, I think. And that's what we're always looking for here, which means what is the best metaphysics that has the most utility, that can explain more of our experience.
That's a great way to say it. And I, you know, when I look at, for example, you know, John's project, you know, even though, you know, as anybody who listens to me knows, I have the world of respect for John as an individual and a person. I'm skeptical about a religion that's not a religion mm-hmm. because the project is just so large. Mm-hmm. And I look at, you know, in my context, the history of Christianity going all the way back through into, you know, the Hebrew world. I don't want to use the word Judaism because of, you know, the part of what happened in terms of how we conceptualize religion and how we label them. But in many ways, this quest is the central quest of humanity. It's our oldest quest. We have more artifacts from this quest than just about anything else. You know, it's so interesting that in almost every case, if you look at ancient history, we have more artifacts from what we would label to be their religious work than often what we would call their everyday work, because their everyday work we look back on as religious. Mm-hmm. And we have a difficult time figuring out the relationship between those two things. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I think what you're looking at is very much a way into that, because, you know, as Peterson continues to note, we're in this enormous world and we have to figure out how to act. Mm-hmm. And most of how to act means, well, it's not just how to, I mean, so Darwin, I think Darwin sees a piece of this in terms of survival, but it's very clear that human beings are not merely focused on survival. And so one way to say, to talk about this is human beings are survival is not the highest value for human beings. It's a very high value, but human beings will trade survival for other goods. And many of those goods historically have been what we today would label religious goods. And I think Persig, in a very sneaky way, and you with your work, now we're using some different words. We're mm-hmm. using quality and we're using value.
Yeah.
Because the, you know, once in our context, we say religious, it's dismissed. I used my wrong hand. I should use my left hand. It's dismissed because the left hand is for dismissing and the right hand is, I'm learning. It takes a while. So so often when I am processing out loud on my videos, Peterson and Peugeot and Fervaeke, your work keeps coming up because it's so integral to all of this. There's this, you know, and it's, I mean, lately Fervaeke has referenced some other scholar who talks about hyper things. And I don't really like that term. I understand its utility in our context because part of this physicalism that we're so deeply embedded in is the need to turn everything into a thing, because that's about the only way we can conceptualize it. It betrays and reveals our biases, but value is not a thing. But it is real. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, the trickiness with this word real is that I'd listen carefully to people and we need to get back to the real world, and they sort of intimate physical. And you want to say, no, and again, in my last videos, on one hand, I'm deeply appreciative of Peugeot's work, because what he is doing is he is now contextualizing the medieval project mm-hmm. and bringing it into our realm. But it's tempting to sort of say, well, if it had not been for Renaissance humanism and the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment, those were all an off-track thing. And if those had never happened, what? If those had never happened, we wouldn't have modern medicine. Mm-hmm. Modern science, those things were going to happen. And now we just have to, I mean, it's in a sense, human nature to always overreach.
Well, you said something interesting. You said, let me find out, I have some notes because sometimes when I'm doing these, I'm like a deer in the headlights. But you said, modernity is played out, it's done. So that means that it's not the wrong track per se. It's just this was a period in history where we did this. And it's, you know, in terms of human history, it's not very long.
Right.
So we've gotten some good things out of it. And maybe it's putting us in a position, you know, as the world becomes less impoverished, let's say. I mean, did you think in your lifetime that you would see Africa thrive to this degree?
No.
You know, and it's amazing. And this is so modernity is putting us all on, it's kind of putting us in the direction of equal footing so that we can, so that we have the luxury, let's say, of reintegrating this ancient consciousness or this medieval, not ancient per se, but this medieval consciousness that allows us to pull heaven back down and integrate with it, to, you know, open up our second eye. To use our right hemisphere, all the things that we're talking, all these analogies that we're talking about.
No, I think that's right. And it's, I think about it. So my wife is a school teacher, and because of COVID, of course, everything got shut down. And then suddenly some parents want their kids back in school. Another one, she has a child in her class who had to spend, she's a Waldorf teacher, so she loops up with her kids. Mm-hmm. This little boy had to fight childhood leukemia for a couple of years, and so got developmentally behind. And now during COVID, this little boy, he's got a younger brother who's a toddler. This little boy has spent a lot of time playing with his toddler brother in sort of toddler ways. Now, as a second grader, you can say, well, that's a second grader shouldn't play in toddler ways. But because this poor little child had to fight cancer and got behind developmentally, he kind of had to go back and work through that stage. And when you get through at some point, then he'll be done playing toddler and be, you know, and he'll catch up to the rest of his classmates because he had this pause. And I think when we talk about modernity being played out, I think we should think about it. You know, I think it's helpful to think about it with a developmental analogy like that
yes,
we needed to, the medieval, there were reasons, and Lewis gets at this at the end of The Discarded Image. He says, you know, he loves this image that has been discarded. It was a powerful image. It was meaningful. This image afforded, it was a massive meaning engine to people who had very, very hard physical lives. And, you know, with the, it all makes sense. And so then to spend, you know, the last 500 years working on the kinds of things that modernity and the Enlightenment and all of this stuff that we've been working on for the last 500 years, those are good things to have worked on. And part of, you know, if you truly rejected modernity, it would show in your life, but it's a little disingenuous to live with air conditioning and automobiles and vaccines and sanitation and hospitals and say, I reject modernity, left hand. And I mean, it's sort of like, you know, why I see a lot of Christians say, I reject evolution, but I'm going to go to a doctor, most of whose models have been built on certain evolutionary models. It's like, okay, but then you really shouldn't believe in the doctor either. And you do. And I'm not pointing fingers because none of us have this worked out. It's just, we have to look at all the data.
That's right.
And maybe we can be a little more kind and generous to one another because none of us have this as figured out as we need to do.
Well, Jonathan Pageot said that science is nested in religion. And I think that that's the stance maybe we're heading towards is, and also in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, one of the conclusions is you take this classical rationality that takes out the value and work with the pieces, but you're doing that as a tool within the value system, within value being on top and rationality being subordinate to that, which is where it was in the past. And you're using this great tool we've got, but you're doing it within this context of value. And that's what we need to do. So we need to make the flip, because what he says is that that Socrates made the flip, you know, 2000 years ago, I guess in the Middle Ages was at one point reintegrated this thing that happened in ancient Greece, which ended up being the Enlightenment, you know, integrated Aristotle, who codified what Socrates did, which is take excellence, value, and flip it to be subordinate, to be aesthetics underneath truth, which is rationality. And now this is, you know, played itself out. And we need to flip back in a way, which is, you know, what we're talking about. But I think I lost my train, but that's
well, and again, it's in what part of what fascinates me is that I hate to invoke another two-level theory, but you know, even in, and this is why I think people who recognize the liabilities and limitations of the certain wave of wokeness need to not be too reactive themselves, mm-hmm. is because in a strange way, postmodernity is doing just that. It looks at modernity and says, oh, come on, you modernists, individuals who are, you are pushing some values underneath that you're not owning up to. Now, the irony of postmodernity is that they're sort of like the kid on the playground pointing fingers, because it's like, oh, postmodernity, in a sense, you're playing the modern trick on modernism, and you have values too. You have meta narratives too.
Oh, yeah.
And so let's stop the finger pointing and maybe put some of our cards on the table and say, okay, here are my values. And I actually think as a Christian minister who's in a strange way is doing what I think is a different form of apologetics, Christians would do far better if they just sort of put their cards on the table and said, here are my values. You know, can I live them out fully? Absolutely not. Can I even understand how to apply these values consistently in society? I'm not that smart, but at least let's begin with the values, and then let's maybe cooperatively, productively work together from there. And there obviously will be conflict, because conflict is an important part of figuring out values. But, you know, part of what at least happened in secularity is that conflict was sort of bracketed to say, okay, I am not going to, you know, Servetus deny the Trinity. Sam Adams in my Discord community denies the Trinity. You should talk to Sam sometime. That would be a fun conversation. I'm not burning Sam at the stake like John Calvin burned Servetus at the stake. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing that we've learned since the early modern period. We're not going to repeat that. And we've learned that as a culture. But okay, so now how can we continue to do this work productively with less bloodshed, but mm-hmm. also still with seriousness?
Well, I think that the wokeness, you know, they deny it's so hierarchical, and yet they completely deny hierarchy, which is the organizing principle of the social world, you know, and there's no escaping this. And this is what you see. This is the, you know, the gist of Peugeot's metaphysics, which I believe to be the metaphysics, you know, that is a mirror of this metaphysics we're talking about. It is a metaphysical manifestation of the social world. Which is, and that's huge, because all of religion is in that strata, in my opinion, and that demonstrates how important that level is, you know, that so having a metaphysics of the social level is no small feat at all. It's really, really important. It's only the dismissive of that, the diminution of this, or the complete denial of this, where the problem is. And that's another thing we've got to get on board, is seeing how important that is.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, would you be interested in going in the direction of talking about the psychedelic?
Sure, that's fine. Okay. I'm pretty open.
I've read your article a couple of times. So I'm going to make a case for it.
Okay.
And I'm going to make a case in a, you know, in a hopefully a cautious way. So in your article, you said that all these things that psychedelics purport to impart can be obtained through other methods, through ritual, through singing, through dancing, through prayer. One thing that I think psychedelics could help with is the fact that modernity has separated heaven and earth to such an extent. And that this isn't, for a lot of people, this isn't, a lot of these things will work if you're already inclined in that direction. If you already have contact with the spiritual domain, let's just say the noetic dimension, however you want to articulate the world to John Vervaeke's real world, then I think that that makes a lot of sense. But because of modernity, because of what's happened, because of this schism from that world, in a lifetime, it might be difficult for a lot of people to get that back.
So you're saying we need a drug to treat modernity.
I'm saying that it may not be for certain people a bad idea, because some people are really blocked. And, you know, they're not just blocked by modernity, but they're blocked by maybe psychological trauma. And we know from this research, you know, that guy Griffiths, this is right near me at Johns Hopkins, that for trauma, it really is a miracle.
Yeah.
And so I think that there is a certain amount of trauma in modernity in terms of the schism and not being able to access this absolutely essential dimension of ourselves. I don't think you can do, I mean, I have a hard time doing therapy if I can't somehow access that transcendent dimension. I might have to do it in other ways. And then I'd like to talk about Peterson and therapist, because I'd like to hear your
thoughts on that.
I think that was the original reason that we were going to talk anyway. Okay. But at least you said that in your video.
Let me first say that I see this religion and psychedelic conversation mm-hmm. as a sub conversation to the bigger psychiatric drug conversation, mm-hmm. frankly.
Yeah.
And so I think these drugs should be studied.
Mm-hmm.
I think these drugs have been miscategorized.
Yeah.
I have talked to enough people who have told me they've been helped by these drugs, but I've also seen individuals who have used these drugs and it's had a negative effect. And again, I say that as a subset of the broader mm-hmm. psychiatric drug conversation, because that's very much my take on that realm. I see, I have a lot more experience with people who have been taking prescribed psychiatric medication, and my watching, I mean, I'm about to use a word that looks positively medieval. And I don't, in that context, I don't mean it as a good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I so regressive. Often see people who have significant, who are struggling in significant ways, and the current medical establishment, try this, and they try that. And so I have far more experience with a significant number of people who are just on this pill regime. Mm-hmm. And that is even a subset of the larger, you know, chemical medicine establishment that we're in. So I want to locate it there, because my questions about psychiatrics or psychedelics are in some ways similar to my response of, doctor, I need to lose weight. Here's a pill. Mm-hmm. I think there are cases where people need a pill or even surgery to address, you know, morbid obesity.
Mm-hmm.
But as a practitioner, I want to say, let's use the chemical treatment as a last resort. Now, your argument, which I really like, may be very true, because again, as a practitioner, I talk to a number of people who are stuck and they want to believe. And I also believe that you're not going to fully appreciate or live into everything that religious faith has to offer if you can't fully engage it relationally in terms of your relational imagination. I think in terms of how we're wired, those are the big guns in what we have between our ears. That is what we are really wired for. And if you can't engage that mechanism, and if you can't really engage God with that mechanism, you're always going to be very limited in terms of all of the goods that can bring into your life. Therefore, and I've seen that people who, I mean, again, if you are raised in it young, all of that stuff is sort of pre-wired into you.
Right.
And it can engage. Now, given the secularity that we've had in our culture, it may well be that there are people, by virtue of how they've been raised, they will never get to those registers. And so I am open to your argument that there might, in fact, be a pharmaceutical, this is insane, but I think it's true, and a pharmaceutical help to address the disability that people have because their parents raised them without religion. And so I'm open to that argument.
But I would also, I mean, I might, you know, I understand what you're saying, using the word pharmaceutical. But the thing is that these substances, you know, and they're ancient pharmaceuticals, but they're pure substances. They come from where we come from. They come from the same biology that we do. So there's an integration available in these substances that might not be in substances that are isolated for a specific purpose. It's like taking the fiber out of, you know, you get obese drinking orange juice because you're not eating the whole orange, you know, you don't have all the fiber and stuff to mitigate the sugar. So you've got these things that are part of the same biology that we are. So there's something to that that maybe can't be measured. It's a value, let's just say, maybe something that can't be measured chemically because the chemicals all line up, whatever. And then they ignore the chemicals they don't want to pay attention to, which always happens. So in nutrition, for example, but the fact that these substances are part of us make it a little bit different from taking a pill, I think.
Well, and I think it's also interesting that from what I've read, you know, I read Pollan's. I read his book.
I haven't read it.
I learned a lot from that book.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting about these, how should we talk about them? Substances, is that unlike, you know, when, you know, so my sister dies of a heart attack at 53, which of course, then my doctor says, well, you should go see a cardiologist. Well, because my sister died. Yeah. Because it's statistics. Okay. So I see a cardiologist. You have an impressive family history, she says to me. And it's like, that kind of impressive, I don't want. So, but then, okay. So we're going to put you on this pill. Now, that pill is that pill and the way that it's given, the white lab coat, the pharmacy, you know, the little pill, the bottle, that is all embedded in a, to now riff on James K. Smith, that is all embedded in a religious liturgy. And so these other substances are, I think if they, from one of the things that we've learned about them, they are going to, the only way they are going to help anybody is if they are also embedded in a religious liturgy.
Yeah. And I would say that the people that you've talked to that had bad experiences didn't have a good religious context for them. I think they do have to have some kind of context that you, a liturgy, let's just say. Absolutely. And on all this, all the research that Griffiths did, because he's a spiritual guy, which is kind of cool. And he said that, you know, the way that they're supposed to use it, it really has to be very, that you have to take it very seriously.
But this is where, again, when Peugeot says we're all, this is all embedded in a religious, which I agree mm-hmm. with religion oh, W, yeah. not religion S, that suddenly, you know, whereas now my cardiologist, so my, mm-hmm. my general practitioner is of biologically of Chinese ancestry, mm-hmm. but goes to a Christian church. My cardiologist is of, you know, appears to be of the ancestry from India, which is not at all common. I live in California. And so,
sure.
And in many ways, I go to these doctors and Christian doctor, Hindu doctor, atheist doctor, doesn't matter. They just give me a pill. And when we're dealing at this level with these substances, these other, oh, what word can I use? In my, within Christianity, in my tradition, we call them confessional, the confessional contextuality of the liturgy surrounding the substance mm-hmm. matters. And so, you know, this is, like I said, I'm open to this conversation because I see the potential.
Yeah.
Having spoken with enough people that, you know, when they talk to me and say, I really want to believe because I can see mm-hmm. in others what they have because intergenerationally, their parents raised them in a tradition. Problems with that tradition, absolutely, but raise them in a tradition. So they have access to relational registers with which to engage the world that I don't have. I am open to the argument that, well, maybe a particular substance embedded in a liturgy can actually facilitate, again, I'm within my own tradition here, which, gosh, I don't know how many people are going to watch this video and the kind of trouble I'm going to get into for what I just said. But that's okay.
Take risks.
but, you know, and I don't think I have betrayed anything in terms mm-hmm. of the questions. I haven't betrayed anything in terms of the lines within my tradition, because every week or every month or every quarter, Christians keep passing out substances in church. We pass out wine. We pass out bread.
That's right.
And we say these are sacraments. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm not naive to the amount of theology I just disrupted. But I think the deeper theology mm-hmm. is potentially there. So,
well, I just thought of an example. So, say you know, Mere Christianity is such a beautiful book. It is so compelling. And say you want to go in that direction, and you've read this, you want to go in that direction, but still, God is an abstraction on the page, because maybe again you've never had this in your life. You know, you never had any. You had atheist parents, and they were, you know, dead set against this, but the words speak to you so much. They're so compelling. They're so beautiful, but you can't get the substance could put the value in there that allows you to have an emotional relationship with this material. And that means you already have the structure in place, and that adds the value. So that's one way of potentially looking at it, because I think what people, you know, what the objection might be if you're a Christian is, well, it's just going to put you into this universal religion, you know, this perennial philosophy, this, groovy state where you're just connecting with the universe, man. And it's, but I think you can, you know, I think in terms of a structured integration of emotion into this abstraction, it could be very useful.
And that's what I see, yeah. That it's analogous to the ways that we use medication today mm-hmm. to pursue well-being. And Christians do that all the time. I mean, I know mm-hmm. that there are Christian sects that, you know, one of my good friends, he was raised in a Christian sect that mm-hmm. pushed away all modern medicine, and he had childhood diabetes. Mm-hmm. Well, that, I mean, that wrecked his life and caused his early death.
Yeah.
And that dismissal, which is an artifact of the fundamentalist modernist fight, mm-hmm. that dismissal ruined in some ways this man's life. It also in some other ways gave him a life that he could never have had without that mess. But that's sort of the mm-hmm. way life in a fallen world goes. So now that's a very interesting argument, and I'm going to have to continue to ponder that and get ready for the blowback from certain parts of my.
Well, let's just say that these patterns are updating. You know, these are social patterns that are updating, and as it becomes more and more acceptable, as it becomes more and more another tool from, you know, another, we've already got these tools from the rational world, and this in the same vein as the tools from the rational world, but also harking back to a very earlier time, which is also, you know, which is partially what we're doing in so many other ways as well.
Yeah. And past, you know, and I made the point, and I'll make it stronger because now I have to, you know, talk about what I wrote because I'm playing around with writing now. So mm-hmm. I get some stuff briefer because who has time to listen to all my video content? There's just way too much of it. But, you know, the argument that somehow Christianity popped out of somebody, you know, the Apostle Paul's trip mm-hmm. and Apostle Paul's accidental trip or mm-hmm. that, you know, for some reason, Christianity was, you know, spiking the wine and, you know, spiking the bread so that everyone in Corinth would, you know, so go on a trip when they did communion. And that's what, you know, that just makes no sense. The idea, part of it is the fact that in terms of a distribution, it seems also clear to me that human beings are, have within them another distribution, which would be, for lack of a better word, propensity to fall into mystical states.
Yes.
And Barbara, was it Aaron Wright, wrote a fascinating book. She's an atheist mm-hmm. living with a wild God. I don't know if you've ever read that. Mm-hmm. She's the woman that wrote Nickel and Dimed. She basically talks about the fact that she's an atheist, but for periods of her life, she just falls into mystical, you know, experiences. And mm-hmm. she writes about it in this book. And she basically says, I don't have the categories by which to explain this. And I would say that's because of when and where you're living.
Yes.
You don't have the categories to explain this, but it's real. And part of, you know, I mean, to Peterson's credit, and if you listen to him carefully, every now and then he'll tell a story. He seems to be one of these people that has a propensity to, you know, to have, mm-hmm. you know, to fall into mystical experiences. And if you are, as an individual, if this is a part of your life, you have to figure out how to integrate it into your world picture. And our current secular society just dismisses it, which is unhelpful. It's a whole range. And so Peterson basically comes and says, here's a whole range of data that you have to take into account. And Sam Harris, no, this is just screwy wiring with the brain, just like schizophrenia or anything else that we have sort of pathologized. So I don't know. That's a rough picture of this because I know even when I just tweeted anything about psychedelics, every time I engage in this, I'm sort of between certain groups of Christians and a whole nother group of people that I've not had a lot of conversation with before I got into this crazy space. And so, and I want to, okay, why would I not just simply line up with my Christian tribe against these other people? Well, because of Jesus, mm-hmm. because the command to love your neighbor as yourself all the way up to and including your enemy or your rival or your adversary. And so, you know, I have to listen to my Christian brothers and sisters over here, and I have to listen to all of these new friends over here and try to myself have a cohesive whole. So that's maybe too long a disclaimer just to protect myself.
Well, Jesus is, you know, it's his word is his mode is dynamic. It's dynamic quality, really, because that is be open to these dynamic relationships, these dynamic updating relationships that could take you to a better place.
And I think, you know, reading the Gospels, when Jesus keeps going up onto mountains to pray,
I was just going to say,
what do you think's happening up
exactly.
there?
Exactly. And when he prays, he says, you know, consider the lilies, which means if you have this open stance, if you're open to dynamic quality to allow you to update your patterns, then you're going to, your trajectory is going to be towards the good.
So, all right. So that's the psychedelics. Oh, the comments are going to be insane.
Well, you know, they're going to be legal soon, and that may change. That may, you know, that will be a updating of social patterns, you know, of legality that may make it a little bit.
I'm really happy that it's being studied because
it's been studied. This guy studied for 20 years. This thing has gone on for 20 years. So it is so rigorous.
And it also seems, you know, a lot of people on Twitter and in the comment section made a point, which I'm very sympathetic to, which I see all the time. Hey, people are just using alcohol.
Yeah.
or pot now.
Yeah.
And nicotine. Yeah. And, you know, just, you know, when we started, I got here a little late and just after, I was distracted a little earlier because outside my door, you know, guy's pacing back and forth and he's yelling at the street and, you know, his turds are on my doorstep. I mean, I live with this stuff all the time. And he always says to me, you know, I don't abuse, I use. And it's like, I think you could use a little bit more community involvement in your self-medication. But the, you know, if, and we have, you know, I am not completely dismissive of psychiatric pharmaceuticals, because I know many people that they have helped tremendously.
It can save people's lives in the right circumstance.
Yes, but it is a categorical difference from setting a broken arm.
Absolutely, and you have to be very judicious with them, I mean, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So maybe we should go into the...
okay, hot potato number two. I said, and it's still... Peterson doesn't seem to be terribly positive of his guild.
Yeah. Let me just ask you right before we start. So you said that you've seen some people get worse with therapy. Can you tell me what you mean by that, or what happened, or what you observed?
First of all, I've seen a lot of people go into therapy and nothing happens. And they spin their wheels. And I think a lot of that is because of the contextuality, the medical contextuality of therapy, where we say, okay, you've got a broken arm, go to the hospital, get it set. And once we put this cast on your arm, you know, in a few weeks, the bone will heal and everything will be okay. So then we see someone that in one way or another is unhappy, acting out, has maybe violated some norms, and rush them to a therapist. And to me, I have seen the most benefit from people in therapy when they themselves see the therapist as a resource that they are pursuing actively to try to help figure things out. But
voluntarily. Yeah.
And so I, when someone comes to me and says, I'm looking for a therapist, I might give them some recommendations of people I know, but in some ways therapy is, and I think that the mini series, The Sopranos, gave a delightful illustration of here's Tony Soprano and, you know, his anxiety, all of this stuff, it's not helping him be a good mobster. And so Dr. Melfi how can I kill people and not experience this discomfort?
Right.
And it's like, I'm not there. And so Christians have tried to sort of enter this realm. And so then I see people who are trying to be Christian therapists, but I sometimes look at some of them and think, I don't know if they're quite cognizant enough to know quite how deep all of this stuff goes, because therapy is always nested within well-being and the values that are part of well-being are situated religiously. And so therapy is sort of like, has sort of been treated like a pill. Now, certain cognitive behavioral therapy and certain elements of therapy are a little bit more, you know, here's this little box and we're going to work on things in this little box.
Yeah.
Are you afraid of elevators? Let's get at that. Mm-hmm. But that's a fairly small thing compared to people I see pursuing therapy when their life is in total disorder. And the goal of the therapist, which is a good goal, is let's help you feel better. Mm-hmm. And let's, you know, often in the context of marriage, here's an unhappy couple. And almost all, every case, both people are contributing to the misery. Mm-hmm. And well, in a short term, one thing that you can do is say, well, if the relationship is what's making you distressed, get rid of the relationship.
Right.
Okay, but there are usually a few other human beings who are downstream from that relationship, ontologically nearly, that for whom the dissolution of that relationship is going to, now it's sort of like, you know, it's a perpetual industry, because let's have the parents split up. All the kids will be in therapy for years. So I can understand, just like Peterson has questions about his guild, I've got plenty of questions about my guild. You just have to open the newspapers to watch pastors behaving badly. It's all over the place. So,
well,
I don't knock him for his skepticism, but at a certain point, I've watched enough of him, and he'll very seldom say, you need to go get therapy for that. And especially when he said, which I don't know how to contextualize, when he said, I've never personally been in therapy. And I thought, everyone I know who is a clinical therapist, part of their training was years of their own therapy.
Right. Yeah.
So no, I heard that statement and I was just like, what? So anyway, so I'm dying to know what you think of all this.
Well, I mean, I'm going to say that his therapy is Jung, Nietzsche, Solzhenitsyn, you know, that I think that literature is his therapy and these grand narrative theories. And I think very much like what you said, his objection to therapy is you're starting at too superficial a level. You have to have an understanding of reality that is, I'm going to use the word metaphysics again. You got to get your metaphysics right first. That's important to go into it with the right worldview. Even if you can't feel good about, you know, even if you're miserable, you still have to, it's more important. He sees mythology as healing, you know, it's more than that. It's metaphysically orienting towards the highest good. So you have to get that orientation there first. Not, I just want to feel better. Your orientation, he feels, should be towards the highest good. And this isn't generally what we learn in therapy school. You know, we're learning modalities to make people feel better. And a lot of these are very, very useful tools. A lot of them are excellent. But the orientation itself, in fact, unless it's Western Buddhism, there's a lot of therapists who are, and I don't mean to disparage my colleagues. I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to explain why I think Peterson has a problem with it. Unless it's Western Buddhism and mindfulness and that kind of thing, religion and spirituality don't come into it much at all. It's a little bit different. I'm out here in the country now, and yeah, they're Christian therapists, but you know, but he's implementing this mythological framework with his clients, and that is front and center, and it scales to all these different things. Even when he uses CBT to get people on the elevator, that is within the framework of you voluntarily, you know, expose yourself to the dragon. He's going to have a mythological underpinning for everything he does. And that, like he was talking about two different types of people, one who can glom onto the imagistic part of mythology and ones who can't. And let's just call them the romantics and the classics, you know, in Persigian terms. But even, and you said this, you said there's people who are image oriented, and then they're the action oriented people. You can use this mythology in both ways. You know, you can use the gospels in both ways. You can use this mythology in both ways. Like the romantics can go into their inner world and explore themselves that way, through this mythological, through this grand narrative. And the outer oriented classic people can use it to structure their physical relationship with their environment. But the substrate is the same. And I think that that's his problem, is we're not taught this. In fact, now I come from an urban area, and maybe here in the country it's a little bit different, but you got really the upper middle class, I shouldn't say that, because the therapists are very diverse, but this cultural thing of college educated, religion is dumb, you know, it's superstitious, it can be explained with evolution.
There's a lot of whiteness in there, to be fair to the wokeism.
And I think that, yeah, and that is where the, you know, wokeism kind of, you know, has a point. So if you don't have that, then what you're doing is really on a superficial level, and you're going from thing to thing, and it can be very fragmented. Although there's some really great modalities, like the Freudian stuff, which he uses, is great. There's a structural element, which I love. My favorite thing is using parts of self, you know, seeing yourself as different parts in conflict with each other. And you can even do this in the Persigian notion of the different levels, because you have all these levels within you. So, and that ends up being, you know, archetypes, or in the religious, in the parables, you have different characters. And I think those represent different parts of self. You could be Cain, or you could be Abel. So the parts of self modalities really are useful. And he uses some of the, you know, modalities that aren't mythological either, because he's really into Carl Rogers, who's an atheist. But he's about relation. How can you express, how can you line up what you think, feel, and do, or think what you think, say, and do in a congruent way? And this is through being seen and heard through another person, which is invaluable. It mimics the loss of ruptured attunement between the child and the mother, which is where a lot of these problems are, as I'm sure you know. And then another thing he's got is a very pragmatic thing, which would, if you are a woke therapist, which a lot of them are now, you know, the five domains of life might not be the things that you're supposed to, you know, that maybe seem patriarchal, which is, you know, community, having intimate relationship, having a job, addressing substance abuse. And there's another one, there's five domains. I forget what the other one is. So that's my take on why Peterson doesn't recommend therapy all that much. And one last thing I'm going to say, which is not that related, but one time he did say, if you're going to find a therapist, make sure they're a psychologist with a lot of research background. Huh. I don't know if I agree with that one. I think that was, you know, because you're really going to have a hell of a time finding a therapist if that's what your parameters are.
Well, I think maybe because I think some of the people listening to this are going to ask the question, because I, for certain people, I do think therapy would help them, and for couples. But I often tell people, I think you have to, in some ways, you have to look for a, you have to search for a therapist, sort of like you have to look for a church, mm-hmm. because fit is really important. And it's, you know, I've known therapists with PhDs. I don't necessarily find the fact that they had a PhD any better. A lot of it seemed to have to do with fit. And fit is this enormously broad term that, you know, we don't know whether this person fits, but this is where we have all this intuitive machinery. Mm-hmm. We just have a sense that this fits. And even, you know, and this is why pastorally, I don't freak out when someone deconstructs, let's say, from Christianity, because often I've seen deconstruction as sort of a developmental step for some people, because often in terms of people's let's, for lack of a better word, spiritual journey, sometimes you need to, deconstruction is a vital step for a lot of people, yeah, to break up some unhealthy things. So outside my house, the city just cited me because I have cracks in my sidewalk and there are trip hazards, and that's, mm-hmm, annoying, because I look at the property the city owns and it's like, hey, keep your own side of the street clean. but at the same time, fair enough, my sidewalk should not be full of trip hazards. But before I can put in new cement that will actually afford the telos of a sidewalk, the old cement needs to be broken up. And I have seen in my own life, I have seen for many people, you know, something has to be broken up. In Christianity, we actually talk about this theologically. We have mortification, which is something needs to die in us, and sanctification, so that something can be set right in us. And so those two things, even in traditional Christian theology, are very much there. Something needs to die in order that something can be set right. And so as someone who works in that field, what kind of advice would you give to someone who, for one reason or another, feels that perhaps some time with a therapeutic professional might be of help to them?
It's so individual, you know. I mean, I think what you said, the only thing that really is a universal is, can you have a relationship with this person? Can you be honest with this person? Because one reason therapy doesn't work is that you're in there for some other reason besides fixing yourself. You know, you're in there for some, I don't know, someone you feel like you should, or you feel like someone told you to. But if you can't open up and be thoroughly honest with someone, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So if you're projecting, you know, if there's too much projection going on and you can't get through that, I mean, a good therapist should be able to see, to, you know, dig through the projection and expose it. But you have to have, number one is to be able to feel comfortable in the room with the person and be able to tell them everything you need to tell them, and I'm not saying tell them everything all at once, because maybe not everything should come out all at once. Maybe you're not prepared, but you should be comfortable enough to be relatively honest at the beginning, hopefully more honest as you go on with the person. And that's really the only one thing I can say is necessary.
And I think, you know, those, I would point to those same kinds of things when people ask, well, what are you looking for in a church? You know, some of these basics, mm-hmm, you know, can you be honest in that space? Can you be truthful? Can you commit to it? You know, at least it doesn't have to be a lifelong commitment, but at least in order to usually to break through, in order to say, okay, this thing in me needs to die, it usually requires a relationship of commitment where there's enough trust. And, you know, again, I've seen in myself and in many other people, there are plenty of chapters in these journeys. You know, at this point in your life, maybe you really had to work on this. And then if you've done the work and you come to a place of completeness, it's like, okay, there's resolution. Now I can move on. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah, once you solve the problem, you open up a whole floodgate sometimes. I mean, when you say move on, I mean, you solve the problem and then you see this expanse behind it, which may not be problematic, but maybe something that needs to be developed and explored.
Yep.
You know, so you got this initial problem and then this whole, and I'm sure this happens with your congregants, you know, they've dealt with this, you know, spiritual crisis, and now they want to develop this whole side of themselves in a much more sophisticated, sophisticated is the right word, but a much more expansive way.
And they have to do it within the context of the life that they have both inherited and developed. So it's an enormously complex thing that we are navigating.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, that was anything else you had in mind? Because I'm curious. So the last few videos, I don't know, maybe we've covered it. Maybe you've said what you want to say, but I'm curious about what the last few videos have sort of prompted in you, because, you know, I think I, like you, and why do I do my YouTube channel? My YouTube channel has brought a lot of good things to me, but one of the real things that I look to my YouTube channel as basically a big learning process for me. And so getting, you know, I'm pretty every day, multiple times a day, I go through the comment section, because commenters give me links, they give me tidbits, and even negative comments or even the most dismissive comments, you know, inform me as to, okay, what maybe am I not missing or not thinking through clearly? What maybe, because if there's a group of people out there who are sort of inhabiting something, well, there's something there then, and that's part of the data. So I don't know if what I've had in the last few videos you've talked about enough. I feel part of what I always do in these conversations is I direct them too much, and that's part of the reason I like my randos conversations, where they just come in and this is what I want to talk about.
I really like what you're, you know, I really like what you're doing. It's so, like I said, it's really, you know, it's inspiring how much stuff you put out there. And, you know, I wish I could, you've talked about ADHD, and I've not been formally diagnosed, but my history, there's no doubt that, you know, I have some variation of this, but mine tends to manifest in kind of getting stuck. And not being able to get the flow, and not, you know, yours seems to manifest in sort of an expansiveness, and mine is a contractedness. So I still have to constantly battle with getting stuff out there, because I get so, you know, I get so, just inhibited.
I've never been diagnosed either, but I look at how I was as a child, and I just think, they would have medicated me if I was in school today.
I'm sure that I would be in the same position. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of tempted to get a diagnosis, but because one thing about it is, then you know it a little better, and then, you know, I mean, at this point in our lives, I'm sure you and I are both very forgiving of ourselves. So I don't even know if a diagnosis would even matter, or what difference would it make.
You know, it brings up for me an issue that I think about with, there's just so much going on. You know, you look at the rise in autism diagnoses and you ask, is it a chemical environmental issue? Is it a, because I look at people of, let's say, a generation older than myself. I know somebody who is he's an interesting guy. He's a world-class expert in, I'm not going to mention what fields, but in certain fields. And he's, you know, I look at him though, and I know him fairly well, and I think this guy definitely would have been put on the spectrum. And by the fact that there was no spectrum, there were no therapeutic treatments, you know, there was nothing of that. And I see many people like this. This person just sort of naively, I don't mean that pejoratively, I mean just without any therapeutic regime at all, this person naively sort of took his challenges and overcame them, and in some ways, in certain hierarchies, ascended right to the pinnacle. And I look at them and I think they never would have reached that height if they didn't have this learning disability. And the world is just strange like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Elon Musk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I wonder, okay, well, are we doing right by our children with this, you know, and in schools right now, mm-hmm. it's, and ironically, the more privileged the school, the more attentive the therapeutic community, because of course, the more obsessive the parenting,
yeah,
as compared to those other schools, which are the underprivileged schools that mm-hmm. don't have the resources. And I look at some of the children coming out of that and I think, probably good thing you weren't in that privileged school, because
that's funny.
You're working your way up. You know, it's like the whole, peanut butter allergy thing. You know, once you tell all these anxious mm-hmm. moms, your kid might have a peanut allergy, and they stop giving their kids nuts, and they basically create the peanut allergy in their kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I look at that stuff, and I guess partly because I feel myself tremendously privileged to sort of sit in a liminal area where mm-hmm. on one hand, I see lots of people with lots of resources and, you know, everything available so that they will achieve the tops of our hierarchies currently culturally. And then I see the other world, which is completely dysfunctional. It's a total mess. And there's tremendous suffering in it that often is mitigated or covered in the, I'll use white world. Why not? They're going to give us that word. Let's use it.
We're already in trouble over the psychedelics.
That's right. Oh, in the world of whiteness over here, which by no means has a lot to do with people's skins. It's this world of whiteness that we've created.
Yeah, yeah.
This other world, which is not the world of whiteness, but I also see in that world, things just play out differently. Mm-hmm. And I can see some of the liabilities of this world of whiteness, that these people that supposedly, because of their lack of privilege, are actually rising up and surmounting and developing. And well, thank goodness they weren't impacted by all that whiteness. And I look at all the whiteness and say, don't be too quick to share that and foist that on these other people.
Exactly. And you know, they're despite the fact that the world of whiteness is trying to convince this other world that they're total victims. I think they're going to be able to power through this one too.
That's right. That's exactly right. Especially because the world of whiteness says, you're all victims, mm-hmm. and whiteness is an ever-present source of evil. So wait for the world of whiteness to somehow grow its generosity to help you. And it's like, did anybody draw this narrative out and say, is this coherent? This makes no sense. You white people, you're so trapped in your whiteness. It's your job to go and fix their non-whiteness. And it's like, no, you know, it's sort of like hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. And you listen to that and you say, yeah, that's right. Hurt people do hurt people. But often hurt people are also the most generous. And your little sayings don't actually fully express the entire dynamic. So
Nope. It's addressing one, you know, it's addressing one modality. It's addressing one modality with the wrong level. Is you know, you're not operating this level, you're operating that level, and they're not, you know, they're not meeting.
Well, anything else you wanted to cover today, Sevilla?
No, Paul, I'm really happy to talk to you. It's been so nice. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, me too.
You know,
me too.
It's been a long time, and I'm enjoying your work. I'm enjoying this journey. I'm enjoying our corner. It's great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for your work and I'll put the link to your channel below. On one hand, I look at your channel and I think, mm-hmm. I don't know why you don't have way, way more subscribers, but people often say that about my channel.
Yeah.
And how I actually feel about my channel is I think, yeah, sure, you know, more subscribers, yada, yada, yada. But on the other hand, would I really want that? Would I really want, you know, a million subscribers.
Yeah, I don't you'd know, be answering a lot of emails.
Yeah, and I don't know if I could use my channel in the same way I use it now if I had that. So I...
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not coming at this from the formal approach that the Persigians, you know, they're not so much active now that Persig's dead, but they're really a lot of philosophy students that have a background that I don't have. So I don't think I appeal to them. I'm working it out, and it's kind of a strange philosophy if you're not a Persigian. So I'm in this really nether world, and I don't put enough content out there. So not having a lot of subscribers, I think, is pretty, makes sense. You know, I think if I put more content, I'd do a little better. If I expanded things, you know, and didn't hammer away at Persig all the time, I'd do a little better. And I am getting out of that now that I understand his philosophy a lot better. And I've had a lot of help because there's been some kind souls that have come in and helped me, you know, who aren't in the, you know, who aren't snobs and who come in and help me with the understanding, because it's not easy to interpret.
Yeah.
And he is saying some things there. It's open to interpretation to some degree, but to another degree, there's a kind of way you have to see it. There isn't one way to see it, but there is at the same time. So, I can kind of understand. But I have enough subscribers that I have a good community. I have a lot of help. I meet interesting people, and I'm part of this corner. And that's, for the time being, good enough for me.
Well, good. Well, thank you, Savilla. And I will put the links to our first conversation. And also your conversation with Peugeot, which was a while ago. Mm-hmm. I really liked that conversation. That was a wonderful conversation. So I'll put a link to that below, too.
Yeah, there's kind of like, he helped me a lot. You know, when I was having some religious struggles, and he helped me a lot. Actually, you see it happening in that conversation.
Yeah. It was good. So one of these days after COVID, we're going to have a conference where we can sort of get a whole mm-hmm. bunch of us from this little corner together.
Yeah, I would love that. I was looking forward to, I was going to book my ticket and everything, but for Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
So I hope that happens. I guess you said it can't happen in 21, but it could happen in 22.
I don't know. It all depends on what's happening with Urban Abbey. And, you know, I was just talking to actually the husband of the organizer of that conference. I talked to him fairly regularly. And, you know, Ontario just has this lockdown right now, which is there, you know, Canada. And apparently the Canadian government has completely mismanaged the vaccination effort. They're telling people that, well, if you got one vaccine from one company, it doesn't matter what vaccine you take of the second one. And you hear this, you're
all right.
really just any two vaccines, that's your plan, Canadian government? Kind of makes a little scary. Poor Canada.
Well, maybe they can come here.
Yeah,
I mean, are they gonna, I hope they can travel here and not have trouble getting back in, so maybe they can come here.
Yeah, we'll figure something out.
I hope so. I think that would be great. All right, Paul, I'll let you go. I know. And I will see you next time.
Okay. Take care, Savilla. Bye-bye.
Bye.